Verse 14, "Now I've come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. And when he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. And behold, one who resembled a human being was touching my lips. And then I opened my mouth and spoke and said to him who was standing before me, 'O my Lord, as a result of the vision, anguish has come upon me. And I have retained no strength. For how can such a servant of my Lord talk with such as my Lord? For as for me, there remains just now no strength in me, nor any has any breath been left in me.' Then one of with a human appearance touched me again and strengthened me. And he said, 'O man of high esteem, do not be afraid. Peace be with you. And take courage and be courageous.' As soon as he had spoke to me, I received strength and said, 'May my Lord speak, for thou hast strengthened me.'" So I told you that 10, 11, and 12 are three components of this vision. That the first chapter 10, which we studied last time, was the story of how he prayed for the answer, or he prayed for the answer to his vision, and the angel, the spirit over Persia, resisted the angel who came with the message for 21 days, and we went through all of that. Chapter 11, which is what we're going to cover tonight, has to do with the near-term fulfillment of the prophecy in the vision. And then chapter 12 is the eschatological fulfillment of the prophecy in the vision. In other words, what's going to happen at the end time. And so he is, Daniel has said, "I was just dumbstruck by this process, and I just couldn't function." It's, I don't know if you've ever had the dream where you're running and you can't go anywhere. Have you ever had that dream? He finds he's just unable to function until the Spirit of God touches him and tells him, "Don't be afraid, take courage. You're a man of high esteem." That'd be a good thing if the Lord's angel could say to you, "You know what? You're a man of high esteem." So he is touched spiritually and enabled to stand in the presence of God. Now, one of the reasons why he cannot stand, why he is powerless, is because the closer we get to the presence of God, the less capable we are of functioning, because we lack the spiritual purity in which to function in the presence of God. And so whenever the Lord shows up, our natural response, when he gets close to us like this, reveals himself, is to go face down. We wind up on our face before the Lord. We are afraid. We're terrified. We're unable to move. It is God is awesome or fearful in that sense. And so we have to be touched, cleansed spiritually in order to be able to interface with him. Moses, who was dealing with God in terms of burning bush, was told, "Take off your shoes, for the ground in which you're standing is holy ground." And anytime human beings in the Bible run into the Lord, or when they run into representatives of the Lord, angels or whatever, they always express that they are afraid or anxious at the experience, that it's overpowering to them, and they have to be spiritually invited or touched to be able to come in. Then he said, "Do you understand why I came to you?" And the question is, "No, I don't. But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince." So the angel is going off to reject the prince of Persia and the Greek demonic principality as well, both of which were trying to prevent this information from coming to Daniel. The Persian principality was trying to harm Israel, and the Greek principality to come was even more hell-bent to destroy Israel in the future. The protective principality over Israel is Michael the archangel. And it seems like a game of spiritual chess between Jesus and Satan, but we are not the pawns, we are the prize. So what he's saying is I'm going to go and push the spirit of Persia out of the way. And when I get done with the spirit of Persia, the spirit of Greece is coming to destroy you and your people, and I'm going to push him out of the way as well. And as we go along, we'll see this. Now, you remember that we've had these visions of the beasts. We started off with a statue that had four in the head and the shoulders and the belly and the legs. And we had the head was Babylon, and the shoulders and whatever was Median Persia. The belly was Greece, and then the legs were Rome. Well, at this particular point in time, we're in Persia now at this game, and so we're in that particular stage. And he says, "I'm getting ready to push the prince of Persia out of your way. But the next big force that's going to come against you is Greece." the third kingdom. Remember, we've had several visions in which these kingdoms have arisen one after another in exactly the same order. They've been told, these are the peoples that are going to oppress you and your people Israel. And so we had Babylon, and Babylon gets pushed out of the way by Cyrus. Cyrus is the king over Persia. Then we had Persia. Persia was the group that dominated Israel. And then Cyrus in Persia sent them home. After Persia, we're going to have the kingdom of Greece. That's chapter 11. Greece and his followers. That's the next great kingdom that's going to oppress Israel. And then the last kingdom that's going to oppress Israel before the coming of the Messiah is Rome, which we'll get to as we go along. And we've seen this vision over and over, right? I mean, he's had this vision three or four times, the same progression of kingdoms. So we have this. One of the things that we're told is that Michael, the archangel, is the patron over Israel. We're actually told this several places in the scriptures. One thing I've told you before is that the archangels seem to be aligned in this way. That whenever Gabriel shows up, an archangel just means angel over other angels. Whenever Gabriel shows up, he always represents the Holy Spirit. He comes to tell Mary that the Holy Spirit is going to overshadow her and she's going to have a child. He comes to Zachary and tells him that his wife is going to be overshadowed and his wife's going to get pregnant by Zachary and she's going to have a child. So Gabriel seems to speak for the Holy Spirit. And Michael always represents Christ. The third archangel was the one who fell, Lucifer. And he seems to have been the one who was serving personally the Father. It was his desire for the seat at the right hand of the Father that caused him to fall in the first place. We read that in Ezekiel 28, and we read it in Isaiah 14. So we're also told that when Satan fell, that one third of the host of heaven fell with him. So we get from here and a lot of other places, and particularly in Jewish angelology, in the Mishnah, in the Talmud, and that sort of thing, this understanding that the angels are divided into three great tiers. And that these tiers of angels are militarily aligned. In fact, the names of those their tiers are powers, thrones, principalities, dominions, and one other thing which I can't remember. But these are Persian military terms. And so the angels are described in that particular way, that they're organized in this fashion, that they were built in an ordered fashion, and that they were in three tiers. And when Lucifer fell, he took one third of the host of heaven with him. So what we see here is that members of that host have tried to make war on Israel, to destroy Israel, and Michael has come to defend them on more than one occasion, and in this particular occasion as well. In Jude 9, we are told that Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of the Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but simply said, "The Lord rebuke you." One of the things that we find out in the scriptures is that when Moses died, that God had to take his body because Satan desired to find it, to use it, to capture it, and use it. I'm sure he would have used it in some sort of a way as to appear, reappear, or whatever, in order to confuse things. So the body of Moses was fought over. And Satan tried to take it, but Michael had to come and take it away from him so that he couldn't use it for his purposes. Little nothing fact, it's sort of a spin-off. It shows up in some places, but there it is. We see this relationship between these angels and how they work. All right, let me read on a little bit and then I'll stop. Daniel 10 through 12, this is a repeat actually of something I said in the last chapter. Daniel 10 through 12 is telling of one great prophecy concerning the corporate future, birth, near future, and eschatological of God's people Israel. This is always a main concern of Daniel when he prays. His messianic nature grieves for his people. He takes personal ownership in their well-being as a people. And having heard discouraging reports about the exiles who had returned to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel, Daniel was grieving and seeking God about Israel's future, which did not at the moment look promising. Now, if you want to know that story, you go to Ezra and Nehemiah, and you read the books in the Bible of Ezra and Nehemiah, and you'll get this whole story of what he's talking about, Zerubbabel. And Ezra and Nehemiah taking the people back, and there's all this controversy and difficulty and all that sort of thing. This prophecy is divided into three chapters because it focuses on three main points. The struggle with Satan to get God's answer back to Daniel is important because it reveals the spiritual nature of the geopolitical evil in the world. That was what we did last week. The near-term future involves Alexander and his successors and their spiritually driven oppression of the beautiful lands, which is what Palestine is, beautiful lands. This is a preview of present-day struggles in the Middle East. We see even today this the struggles that are going on now as spinning out of this particular thing. And then the eschatological events that precede the second coming, the emergence of the Christ. So chapter 12, the last chapter, will be about the end time. So Daniel 11, 1 to 35. Before I start reading in that, are we all together? We should be, but are we? Everybody cool? All right, good. Daniel 1:35. In the first year of Darius the Mede, which is 536 B.C., I arose to an encouragement and a protection for him. And now I tell you the truth, behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them, and as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire and against the realm of Greece. So what happens is Daniel is talking to Darius, the Mede, and he is telling him about what's going to happen in 536. So the details are of Daniel's vision, announced in chapter 10, are found in the last two chapters of the book of Daniel. Remember, Daniel prayed for an answer, and this is the answer, okay? And he's telling Darius, it concerns both the near-term and eschatological future of Israel. It outlines the political forces arrayed against Israel going forward. Daniel is always and mainly focused on Israel and her national future. That is his issue. Some scholars believe that Cyrus the Persian was also Darius the Mede. He would have been identified uniquely in both subcultures. Peter, as you remember, was known as Simon to the Jews and Petros, or Peter, to the Greek-speaking Gentiles. Carlos Estevan, brother of Emilio, is also known as Charlie Sheen. We call him Charlie, but his mother calls him Carlos. But that's a fact. It's true, folks. I'm not making it up. So
I missed that in the book of Daniel. I must find it.
People have multiple names because they operate in multiple cultures. That's the point. Those with half a brain got that. Okay. All right.
At least one half works.
This first little section that we have here, we see a succession of four kings. All right, that is Cambyses, which is in 529 to 522, Pseudo-Smyrnus, which is in 522 for 6 months, Darius the First, or Hystaspes, who is the Great, 522 to 486, and Xerxes, who's the Greek name of king called Ahasuerus by the Jews in 486 to 465. He was called, I can't even say that one, Kayarsh by the Persians. He's a major thorn to the Greek city-states. He ignites the passions of Greece to conquer Persia and its vassal states. His defeat at Salamis caused him to take comfort in his harem, and the failure of Queen Vashti to honor him got her deposed. So this is the king of the Book of Esther who was named as his replacement. So Daniel is telling Darius, this is what's going to come after you. There's these kings. Remember what he said here. Three more kings are going to rise in Persia, then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them, and as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. So what he's saying is to Darius is, after you're going to come three kings, and the fourth one who comes is going to be stronger than all the rest, he's going to own more than all the rest, and he's going to provoke Greece in a major way. And as it happens, that's what happened. Cambyses, Pseudo-Smyrnus, and Darius first came along, and then after him, Xerxes, who is called Ahasuerus by the Jews, or Kashyarsh, or whatever his name is, by the Persians. And he basically consolidates most of the world, and his next and last target is Macedonia, Greece. And in the process, he provokes Alexander and the Greeks to come against him. If you've ever seen any of the stories about this, his armies outnumbered Alexander enormously. He had huge, huge armies, and he thought he was going to do that. Alexander whipped his butt at Salamis, and then he goes home with his tail between his legs, and just kind of pouts for a while. And while he's pouting, he decides to have some fun in his harem, and he throws a big party, and he wants his Queen Vashti to come out there, and he wants to show everybody off what a dish she is. There's nothing like having a bunch of drunk noblemen, lords, and generals ogling you to make you feel really important. And Vashti was too proud for that. She would not come out, and it was she was deposed. They went out looking for a new queen, and God miraculously raised up Esther Hadassah, a young Jewish girl, and she became the queen. So if you read the story of Esther, that's how that fits in the story. But a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not by his own descendants, or not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside them. And the answer to this is that 150 years later, after Darius, Alexander the Great and his Greeks conquer the Persians. This is Xerxes has provoked him, and then Alexander comes over and conquers them. The campaign took only 13 short years, from 336 to 323. He was 33 years old when he died, leaving only two small children who were assassinated. His empire is divided among his four generals, Seleucus in the north, which is Syria, Babylon, Iraq, today's Iraq, and Palestine. Ptolemy in the south, which is Egypt. Lysimachus in the east, which is Thrace and Bithynia, or Asia Minor. And Cassander in the west, which is Macedonia, Greece, and Western Europe, or Rome. So Daniel said that's what's going to happen next. Verse 5. Then the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. And his dominion will be a great dominion indeed. And after some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. This is what the angel is telling Daniel is going to happen. This is what actually happened. Ptolemy the first, the Ptolemy who was one of the generals of Daniel, who controlled Egypt, emerges as a strong force with the help of Seleucus. Seleucus is the guy in the north. So basically the two of them consolidate power between the two of them and push the other ones out of the area. With the help of Seleucus, it gains control of a vast empire around 312 BC. Now Berenice, daughter of Ptolemy II, marries Antiochus II, the grandson of Seleucus I in 252. So in the process of these kingdoms establishing themselves and whatever, trying to create an alliance, Berenice, the daughter of the son of Ptolemy I, marries Antiochus II, who's the grandson of the Seleucus guy. By doing so, she displaces Antiochus' first wife, Laodicea, and her son. Now, there is the city called Laodicea. Paul writes to the Laodiceans. He talks about the seven cities of Revelation. There's the city of Laodicea. That's named after this gal, Laodicea. She was Antiochus' first wife, and in order to have seal this agreement, she gets deposed along with her son, who would be the heir. And instead, Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy, marries into the family with the idea that their son, her son, would rule both kingdoms. I mean, that would be the ultimate thing, if they can blend their families and rule it all. But she will not pay, this is Berenice, she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. So this Berenice, her plan is not going to work. Neither is the plan their plans aren't going to work. She's going to be deposed, okay? But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. So he's going to come up from the south. He's going to enter into the king of the north's fortress, and he's going to take over. He's going to demonstrate power. And also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, he will take into captivity in Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. Then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south and return to his own land. Will enter into the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. So this guy's going to, because of Berenice pushing Laodicea out of the way, she's going to get deposed. That plot's going to fail. The king of the south is going to come up in response to that, his sister getting pushed out of the way. And he's going to move into the kingdom of the north, and there's going to be this big battle and struggle, and he's going to go home. Now, that's what the prophecy says. Let's see what happened, okay? Upon the death of Ptolemy II, Berenice was deposed and murdered along with her supporters by Laodice and her son, Seleucus II. All right, so the Laodice who was deposed, the first wife of Seleucus I, was she has Berenice deposed and murdered, and all her supporters pushed out of the way. Berenice's brother, Ptolemy III, avenges her death and defeats the Seleucids. So he comes north and defeats the Seleucids. He executes those who murdered Berenice, and he conquers the Syrian capital. He loots Damascus and Antioch of many treasures and sends it home to Egypt. He then agrees to a 10-year truce with Seleucus II and goes home to Egypt. That is actually what happened in history as it relates to this particular prophecy. And part of what we're going to see tonight is Daniel gets this roadmap of prophecy that is extraordinarily specific, and then what we're going to do is tell you what actually happened. We have the advantage here of getting a prophecy from Daniel that's futuristic to him, but past to us. And so we have the ability to look and see what actually happened. When Daniel is prophesying into an age that's ahead of him but behind us, we and Jesus and everybody else can point to it and say, that's what happened. When Daniel is prophesying into an age that's yet to come for us, we obviously can't have that same kind of experience. But we do have some confidence that if he's that good in the past, he'll be that good in the future. If Jesus has confidence in him in the past, that he'll be that good in the future. I mean, I think one of the main reasons that this, for us, that this passage is in here is to establish just that much confidence. Now, you got to remember, when Daniel said all this, none of it had happened. And wouldn't happen for over 100 years. All right. And his sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will come on, keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. And the king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Now remember, when you hear south, you're thinking Egypt. When you hear north, you're thinking Seleucia or Syria. You're thinking the Seleucid kingdom. Okay. So the king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given in the hand of the former. And when the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, and yet he will not prevail, for the king of the north will again rise, raise a greater multitude than the former, and after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. Okay? So Seleucus II's son, Seleucus III and Antiochus III, raise armies against Egypt. This is in response to the fact that the Egyptians had come up and captured the Seleucid Empire and taken their treasures away, and they had a truce for 10 years, and after the boys grow up, they decide to fight back. Now, in the north, in the Seleucid Empire, all of your kings are going to be named either Seleucus or Antiochus. So you get this Seleucus 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th, or Antiochus 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, etc. And then the Ptolemaic kings, they're for the most part going to be named Ptolemy. In some ways, it's sort of like Pharaoh. It means that that's the ruler. They got other names like Joe Smith, you know, and Fred Johnson, but they are, that's not how they're known. When they become king, they take the royal name, and that sort of thing. So, let's see, where am I? So, Seleucus II's son, Seleucus III, and Antiochus III raise armies against Egypt. Ptolemy IV, who's a peaceful man and a good general, defeats them handily. He kills over 15,000 Syrian troops, which relates to verse 11 and 12, in 217 B.C. He fails to consolidate his hold on Palestine because worldwide domination is not his goal. He's really just trying to protect his own interests, and he doesn't go in and consolidate Palestine. Now, one of the things that we see as we go along here is that if you're doing battle, if you're Egypt doing battle with Syria, or you're Syria doing battle with Egypt, and you're going back and forth to the war, and you want to, where you really want to be waging war is on the other guy's turf, that means you've got Palestine on your rear. And the last thing you need is an unprotected flank. And so what you're doing is, What you should be doing is consolidating your power in Palestine so that you can use it, for instance, to stage your munitions and stage your supplies. And, of course, you can also rape and pillage the land so that you can have supplies and stuff like that. And the problem with being Palestine is you get tired of being run over by this kingdom versus that kingdom. You get tired of having your land pillaged for the sake of these various armies. You really don't like it when they come and take your daughters away for fun. And you don't like it when they enslave your children and make them do the work for you. So you're a ping pong ball caught in the middle, back and forth. And so what happens is that either the Seleucids in the north or the Ptolemaic Egyptians in the south, all of whom are Alexander's offspring or successors, they are constantly pounding on Palestine. So when Daniel's being told that Greece and its people and its successors are going to be the next great force to dump on Palestine, this is what he's talking about. Okay. Now, in those days, verse 14, in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. Who's the king of the south?
Ptolemy.
And Ptolemy's based in?
Egypt.
See, you guys are getting this. This is good. I sound like Steve on Sunday, don't I? You get one right answer and all of a sudden they're all geniuses. That's good. All right. Now, in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. So your people, who are your people? When he's talking to Daniel, who is your people?
Israel.
He's saying the violent ones among your people are going to rise up, but they're going to fall down. Then the king of the north will come and cast up a siege mound and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. Now Jewish insurgents futilely attempt to drive Ptolemy out of Israel. When Ptolemy the fourth dies, Antiochus III raises yet another Syrian army and drives the Egyptians out of Palestine, and this is in 201 B.C. He enters Jerusalem to the delight of the Jews in 198 B.C. He reaffirms Jewish religion and practice suppressed by the Egyptians, and he dwells there for a season as a defense against the Egyptian resurgency. Now, this particular guy, I think this is the third...
Antiochus III.
His particular style is that he doesn't need Israel to give up their culture or their religion. He basically comes in, and if you have a battle against Egypt and you're Syria, and Egypt has overrun Israel, one of the things you can do is make an alliance with Israel that you will go and join them if they will go and join you, and together we can push this guy out, and then you're friends, you're buddies, right? And so that's what happened here in this particular instance.
Dwells there for a season.
For a while. It's just that's a vague term. For a while. History will tell us how long it was, but the word there just means for a while. All right, you see.
17.
And he will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom and bring with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it. But she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many. But a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So he will turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more. So Antiochus III offers a truce and his daughter in marriage to Ptolemy V. Her name was Cleopatra, the first one, not the one you all know about, the first one. Her name was Cleopatra. However, she's the daughter of Antiochus, and she's married in a state marriage to the Egyptian Ptolemy V. She sides with her husband. So once she gets there, she takes her considerable influence, and she sides with her husband against her father and undermines the truce, which fulfills Daniel's prophecy. Antiochus then moves to capture and fortify Asia Minor, which is Anatolia or Galatia, on the Mediterranean Sea. He is soundly defeated by the Roman general Scipio in 190 B.C., and this is the beginning of the Roman hegemony in the region. Up until this point in time, Cassander and his Romans stayed out of the picture. But when Antiochus moves to fortify Asia Minor, which is really off to his east, it's not really south at all. And why is he doing that? He's doing that so that he can, these wars are getting expensive. And he's got to develop more places of tribute and all that sort of thing. And so he needs materials, he needs men. And so he moves into Asia Minor for the purpose of consolidating his kingdom. And when he does, the guy who's over there, his name is Lysimachus, his offspring, who by now they're coming on, actually make a deal with the Romans, who are the offspring of Cassander. And Scipio, the general, comes over in 190 BC and pushes Antiochus out of Asia Minor. Antiochus died in 197, looting a temple in Susa to raise the tribute money. It goes from bad to worse. In order to pay the Romans tribute, he is in a temple of the Medes in Susa. And he's pillaging this, and the local populace rises up and kills him. So he is gone, as they say. Then in his place will one arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. Yet within a few days he will be shattered, though neither in anger nor in battle. And in his place a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred. But he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. The overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. Now, we've got this person who's going to come into the scene who's going to take over by intrigue and by who's not really a king, but he's going to take over by intrigue. Antiochus III's son, Seleucus IV, then tries to raise the money through taxation, but he is soon assassinated. Seleucus IV's brother executes the assassin and murders Seleucus's minor son through intrigue and assumes the reign as Antiochus IV. Okay, so let me say that again. Seleucus IV tries to raise the money in order to be able to do what his father couldn't do, which is pay the tribute. But he is assassinated. His brother, who is not in line for the throne, because that actually belongs to Seleucus' son, executes the assassin and murders Seleucus' minor son in order to gain the kingdom, and through intrigue assumes the throne as Antiochus IV. Antiochus IV is also known as Antiochus Epiphanes. And the word Epiphanes means he appears. Antiochus Epiphanes. He just kind of appeared on the scene. He was not a person who would naturally come in the line. He just sort of showed up and was there. And that's why he's called Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus IV. He is the one who Jesus points back to as the type of the Antichrist. And we'll see why as we go forward here. So, after an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception. Now, this is twice we've been told that he's a sneaky son of a gun. He will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm. He will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against the stronghold, but only for a time. So this is a despicable man who has no honor and schemes incessantly against everyone. This is a manipulator. This is what this guy is all about. Verse 25, and he will stir up strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army, so the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty armor for war. But he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. And those who eat his choice food will destroy him. His army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil. They will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he will reign in his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. Okay. When Cleopatra I dies in 176 BC, Antiochus IV, this is the guy who's the interloper, he was the brother of Seleucus V who died, who killed Seleucus' son. He's the deceiver. He's the guy who's been consolidating his power by using booty and plunder and whatever from everywhere in order to buy into it. So he marches against Egypt, and through intrigue, he conquers a superior Egyptian force in 170 to 169 BC. He becomes a protector of her son. In other words, This is a subterfuge. He basically says, I'm here to protect Cleopatra's son. He's going to be the king someday, but until he's old enough, I'm going to make sure everybody takes care of him. So basically what he does, he winds up conquering Egypt for a time in this particular manner. So he becomes a protector of her son, Ptolemy the Fourth, giving him control over Egypt. Egyptians made Ptolemy the Fourth's younger brother an opposition king and fortified Alexandria. So when Antiochus the Fourth captures young Ptolemy and basically the throne, the Egyptians take his younger brother and move to Alexandria and set up a counter government there. And so there's this struggle between these two brothers. Okay. Now, they're probably, 5 and 9, but there's, at any rate, their people are fighting for them, okay? And by the way, this is how it's done. I mean, English kings and queens are often minors when they take over the throne, and somebody like Cromwell or some of these kind of people wind up, he was called the Lord Protector of England because he actually took Edward the Fourth or something and ruled for him until Elizabeth came along. Lord Cromwell. At any rate, so Antiochus made a futile attempt to defeat him in Alexandria, that is the younger brother. And when he failed in the attempt, he retreated to Jerusalem. So he having captured the young Ptolemy the Fourth, and he moves to Alexandria to try to capture and kill the alternative government. Had he been successful, he would have controlled Egypt and the Seleucid Empire all at the same time. But he's defeated there. And so he goes back to Jerusalem. He despoiled the temple of much treasure and went home. And the two Egyptian princes then reconciled and co-reigned together. This is what happened after he left. They joined forces, which is what the prophecy was saying. At the appointed time, he will return from into the south, but this time it will not turn out the way it did before, for the ships of Kittim will come against him, and therefore he will be disheartened. So rearming himself, he makes another attempt to conquer Alexandria, but the Romans on the ships from Cyprus, or Kittim, arrive and tell him to back off. Now, this is the second time we've seen Roman hegemony coming into this particular area. They're beginning to get stronger and stronger, and they're starting to have influence in as far west as Palestine. Because remember, what's going on with their world is somewhere out east of that, where Spain and Germany and Gaul and France and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But by this time, we see they're becoming active over here in the area of Palestine. So Antiochus capitulates without a fight and falls back upon Jerusalem. Roman dominance of the Mediterranean grows from this point. All right, and then Antiochus will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Now, let me stop and take a moment here because we're getting ready to get into a whole bunch of what's important to us in our age and in the end time. So far, what we've just been seeing is the prophecies of Daniel forward for him, but you know, past for us. Now, let me share with you part of what's going on. When these Jews are getting overrun by these two kingdoms over and over and over and over again, over hundreds of years, okay, over and over and over again, they have this constant struggle. Do we continue to remain Jews, or do we give in to this pressure to Hellenize? Now, everybody knows what Hellenism is, right? Hellenism is the influence of Alexander's Greece, the Macedonian ways of thinking, doing, and whatever. It's the Greek language. It's things like the gymnasia, the Greek practices, the religious practices, the sexual practices, all that sort of thing. The Jews, as you know, have a covenant to maintain their Mosaic culture before the Lord, and to become Hellenized is to become syncretized. To get rid of some of what they believe, to embrace some of what the world believes. And this is forbidden to them. So these attempts by these various rulers to Hellenize the Jews, and both sides are trying to do it, have met with various results. There are always, in all societies, and there is so also in Israel at this time, those people who, frankly, are just interested in making money. They want to do business. They don't see any reason they shouldn't get along with everybody. They, frankly, quit believing in the fairy tales a long time ago. And it's just fine with them. They develop Hellenistic ways. They start going to the gymnasia. They start, they have business associates in the Hellenistic world. They don't, you know, they feel a little bit ashamed of their people. They don't want to come across as old fogies and whatever the case may be. They're sort of apologetic for that goofy group of religious fanatics in Israel or whatever. And so they embrace Hellenism. And they also have quit going to temple a long time ago. They're no longer participating in those kinds of things. To them, it's just something that used to be. Then you've got people on the other end who are absolutely rabid Jews, and they refuse to synchronize one ounce. They won't take on they won't wear the Hellenistic robes. They won't eat the Hellenistic food. They refuse to speak Greek, and so you've got all of this stuff that's going on. The people who are conquering them over the ages find this a nuisance. Because what they've got is they've got within this land that they have almost always tried to either by treaty or by force to make into a support area for them, a staging area. They've got this internal squabbling over religion. They can't get these people to lighten up, you know, and to get with the program. They should get rid of their old-fashioned God, you know, these old stories, the old myths, none of which are true, blah, blah, blah. And they should become good Hellenistic people like the rest of the world is, you know, all that sort of thing. And so they beg and cajole and plead with these Jews to become Hellenized. When that doesn't work, they decide a different tact. And now we get to Antiochus IV. What happens is that he's had himself, he had the world by the tail. He had captured the Egyptian prince. For all practical purposes, he had a hold of the Egyptian government until they took his kid's younger brother, set him up as a counterprince in Alexandria, and he thought he'd march on down Alexandria and clean their clock and settle this thing once and for all. By now, he is feeling like big stuff. And he gets down to Alexandria, and he just everything falls apart. It doesn't work. He can't pull it off. And so he just gets kind of ticked off. He goes home. And, you know, and as he's going home, he's going through Israel. And as he's coming in through Israel, I mean, his governors are going, we got all these problems, there's this stuff and whatever. And he's got no time for this. And he's getting irritated and whatever. So he goes back and he gathers a new force in the spring when it's time to fight again. He goes back down. And by this time, these two brothers have hooked up together. They're co-ruling. And he's just going to stomp them all. And here comes these interfering Romans out of nowhere and tells him to back off. Well, I mean, he's pretty sure he can whip the Egyptians. The last thing he needs, though, is trying to whip the Egyptians, which has not been as successful as he thought it would be. He's got trouble on Palestine on his flank, and the Romans are now threatening him that if he doesn't back off, that they're going to join in with the Egyptians. That he doesn't think he can deal with. And so he's upset. And he goes back to Jerusalem, and when he gets there, he does what a lot of time we do as human beings, and that is he just beats up the first weak thing he can find, which is the Jews. It's just, you know, he can't beat the Romans and he can't beat the Egyptians, and so there are the Jews, you know. It's kind of like an abusive husband. Here he comes. All right, so Antiochus will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the covenant. He is going to side with those people who forsake the covenant. Okay? And forces from him will arise and desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up an abomination of desolation, Daniel says. And by smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Now, news of his reversals emboldens the Judeans who lay siege to Antiochus' hand-picked high priest. This is historical fact. When the Jews, remember there's these Jews who are real Jews, and they're really tired of these people coming in and trying to Hellenize their world. They are tired of these Jews who betrayed them and joined sides with these other people. And when they see Antiochus get his tail whipped a couple of times, it emboldens them. And so these Jews, and by now we've got a full-blown counter-revolutionaries in Judea. It is a truth that when you fight the Judeans and they are outnumbered, what they do is they hide in their hills and they hit and run. And you just can't get chariots up there. You can't get large armies up there. In the hills, a few can kill a lot. especially if the few are on top and the lot are coming up from the bottom. And so it's just they're emboldened. And so they basically get a hold of Antiochus's handpicked high priest. In other words, Antiochus by politics has set in place a high priest, a Jewish high priest, who is his guy. And so they get a hold of him, lay siege to him. Antiochus is enraged. He comes to Jerusalem and he puts down the resistance. He supports the Hellenized liberal Jews who have forsaken the covenant. He desecrates the temple by putting a statue of Zeus in the Holy of Holies on December 25th, 167 B.C. He sacrifices pigs on the altar. He also dedicates the temple to Baal, the local god. And the morning, evening sacrifices are stopped for 150 days, which is 2,300 morning and evening sacrifices. But the followers of Yahweh rise up in defense, especially the Maccabees. Now, the real Jewish high priest, and I forget all these names, but I think his name is Simon, and he has five sons. And his second son, Judas, is known to be one tough guy, and he's called Hammerhand. Judas the Hammerhand. And the Hebrew word for that is Maccabeus. Judas Maccabeus. And so Simon and his sons gather these, they're leading this revolution inside of all of this process. And they take on this counterinsurgency kind of a thing, just like the Al-Qaeda is doing to all of us today. Just like we did to the British when they came over here, and just like the Vietnamese did to us when we went over there. And they hit and they run, they hit and they run. Of course, they're in their own land. They've got their own people hiding them. They know where the stuff is. They know how to get places. They have dug tunnels from one place to another that they know about that other people don't. Sound familiar? And they can come out from behind you and whatever. And they're absolutely driving what is actually a pretty fine army crazy. And so basically Antiochus IV has his Vietnam. That's basically what happens here. Okay, and it is led by Judas Maccabeus, his brothers and father, the Hammer Hand. If you have a Bible that has the 46 books of the Old Testament as opposed to the 39 books of the Old Testament, which means you have the Apocrypha, with the extra books of the Old Testament, two of those books is 1st and 2nd Maccabees. They make great reading. It's a whole lot about all this whole thing. It's more historical information about all of this. There is a better book that I recommend to you. I don't know if it's still in print, but you can probably find it on Bibliofind. And it's called My Glorious Brothers. I read this when I was younger, and I doubt very seriously it's in print anymore. But if you go to Bibliofind, where they sell old books, and try to find My Glorious Brothers, it is a novel, historical novel, built around the fight of the Maccabeans. And it's all about Judas and his brothers and whatever, and how they stood up to the Seleucids and whatever. So it's a wonderful book. It's a good read. If you like the... Who's that gal we read a lot?
Rivers,
Francine. Yeah, Francine Rivers. You like her or that kind of stuff? This is a great read. It's called My Glorious Brothers. I couldn't begin to tell you more who wrote it. So, but it was one of the. I always remember this book. In fact, if I got a copy, I'd read it again myself. It's so much fun. All right.
At this time, with the morals of the Greeks and the Romans, the same or similar?
The morals of the Greeks and the Romans are pagan, and they're all the same. They all believe in the same things. They're pagans. They're sexual worshipers. They're hedonists. They have different philosophical positions in both cultures. Some of them are Stoics and ascetics. Others are Epicureans and gluttons and hedonists. They're spread out. There's Republicans versus Republicans. I mean people who believe in the Roman Republic, as opposed to people who are looking to build a kingdom or an empire, which is different than a republic. And both cultures have all the same sort of struggles. Now, at this particular point in time, the Greeks aren't much because they've been divided into four categories by the downfall. Remember, Alexander was 330 B.C. We're down to 167 B.C. We're a century and a half later. And by now, the Greek world is... Hellenism's still around, but Greece as a major power is gone. It got divided up. And the area that is, it was Greece, is now under the control of Rome, of the emerging Romans.
So
Okay? All right. Okay, verse 33. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by thunder for many days. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. And some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine and purge and make them pure until the end time, because it is to come at the appointed time. So Mattathias, an Orthodox priest from a town near Jerusalem, killed a Syrian officer who was coming to enforce the pagan sacrifice in the temple. He had five sons. Judas the Hammer then led an insurgent force against the Syrians and their Jewish collaborators for 3 years. Against overwhelming odds and at the cost of many lives, they prevailed. And then on December 25th, 164 B.C., they cleansed and rededicated the temple. These hard and difficult times purged Israel's religious practice and led to the rise of Phariseeism, a strict adherence to the law of Moses. So what happens is because of what they went through here, where you had a culture in which you had very religious Jews and very secular Jews, and the very secular Jews were aligning themselves up with the domineering power, and the very religious Jews wound up, as it were, driving that power out. The whole atmosphere in Israel moved toward very conservative and literal interpretation of the scriptures. And the movement that developed out of that was Phariseeism. So after this particular point in time, Phariseeism becomes the dominant religious force in Israel, even down to the time of Christ. Now the Pharisees represent a smaller percentage of the Jewish people than their influence. They might have been 20% of the people, but influenced 70 or 80% of the policy. The Sadducees were more like the liberal guys that got pushed out of the way. And they once again side with the powers. The Sadducees, at the day of Jesus, Ananias, Caiaphas, all those kind of people, they were in league with the Romans. The reason why they had power, rather they were the high priests, is because the Romans set them in. Ananias was a godfather. He was a horrible man. He had five sons, and at the time, and they were all at one time or another high priests. They just kind of traded around. At the time of Jesus' death on the cross, his son-in-law Joseph Caiaphas was the present high priest, but Ananias was the power. If you read the Gospels, you can see that. And at one particular point, late in the scriptures, I think it's in the book of John, but I'm not sure. When Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead and he comes into the city and the people acknowledge him as the Messiah, Ananias says to his followers, "This man we have to kill this man, because if we don't control him, the Romans are going to come and take our place." Now what he means by that is our position in society. They're going to come and take away the controlling influence that their deal with the Romans is you keep the peace, we'll let you keep your religion. You keep the peace, we'll let you run the temple. You keep the peace, we'll let your temple priests go in there and drag them out. We won't go in and violate your temple. You don't keep the peace, all bets are off. So when Jesus begins to become so powerful, so popular, that they begin to realize that the Romans are going to have to rise up and deal with this, and they certainly have lost control, they go, "We got to kill this guy, and we got to do it now. Because if this gets much worse, either the Romans are going to rise up and stomp him and take away our slot, or his people are going to take over, in which case the Romans will come against us anyway." But it says, he says very clearly, we have got to kill him, because if we don't control him, the Romans are going to come and take our place. That's a quote from the scripture. That's Ananias. So at the time of Jesus, you've got the Pharisees, who are 23% of the people, but controlling much of the religious culture of the day. The Sadducees, who are the liberals, who are political beings. And some people have a tendency to think of the Pharisees as Jesus' enemy. He actually wasn't. The Sadducees were actually the people who tried to kill Jesus. The Pharisees and Jesus and his followers clashed because they were so close to each other, not because they were so far apart. Both the Pharisees and Jesus preached holiness in the land, that we should live in holiness before God. The Pharisees preached that you did that by keeping the law. Jesus preached that you did it by relationship with the Father. And that's why they clashed. Not because they were different, but because they were the same, but their methods of how to get to where they were going were so different. It was the Sadducees, however, who killed Jesus. When a push comes to shove, that's who did it. Then there were the Zealots. The Zealots were another group of people in Israel at the time of Christ. And their whole thing was, is we need to restore God's Jerusalem by throwing the Romans out. We need to be the Maccabees. We need to tap onto the spirit of David, the warrior, Solomon and his power, Samson and Ehud and all these various Joshua, Moses. We need to tap into that great military strength that we've had in the past and drive out the Romans. That was their version of what it meant to be a Jew, a religious Jew. Drive them out of the land. Then you had the Essenes. The Essenes were people who were by and large monastic. They lived in the deserts. John the Baptist grew up in an Essene community. They were Pentecostals. They believed in speaking in tongues. They were dancing all over the place. They were having visions. They had great long prayer services. They preached for hours. They wore high head buns than their women did and helmet hair for the men. Just kidding. But they were your typical Pentecostals. And that's where John the Baptist came from. They were Nazarites, many of them. They lived apart. Their attitude was, is the whole thing's going to hell in a handbasket, and we're going to live out here and wait for the coming of the Lord. And so that's what they did. So that was another group. Those are the major political religious groups in Israel at the time of Christ. And at the Pharisees, the one that dominated the landscape, grew up out of this particular circumstance here in 164 B.C., 167 to 164. Let me go on for just a second and I'll stop. Now, these very hard and difficult times purged Israel's religious practice and led to the rise of Phariseeism, a strict adherence to the law of Moses. For practical purposes, Israel enjoyed independence for the next 100 years until Rome conquered them in 63 B.C. under Pompey. The Feast of Hanukkah is derived from this period. An oil lamp must burn at all time in the Holy of Holies. The oil must be ritually pure and dedicated for this purpose. Only one qualified vial of oil was found for the rededication. Miraculously, it is believed the single one-day vial burned for 8 days until some more could be produced. Hence, Hanukkah, meaning dedication, was celebrated from 27 Kislev to 2 Adar, which is from December 25th to January the 2nd. Hanukkah occurs nearer at the same time the Christian celebration of Christmas and is also known as the Feast of Lights. That's in today's world. The Feast of Dedication is mentioned in the New Testament as well. So Daniel's prophecies about all that that happened at this particular time in the near future. He's asking God, what's going to happen to my people? God's telling him. And at this particular set of prophecies is for the near future. Future to Daniel, past for us. In the near future, meaning within the next 150 or so years. And what he said was what you said, what you read, and what happened is what I filled in for you there. This particular explanation you can find in 100 books. This is not hard to find. This is pretty much old hat. Now let me stop for a minute and see what you want to say. Yeah.
Yeah. The last couple of lines on was page 51 in our book, verses 33, 34, 35. I'm not clear on those. You talk about those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. Now you're talking there about good guys or bad guys.
Good guys.
Alright. But then it says, now when they fall, they'll be granted a little help, and many will join them in hypocrisy. Who's that? I mean, I'm getting confused at which group.
Yeah, well, that's easy enough to do. It's even easier to do in English than it is in the Greek when you read the Septuagint. But what he's... Yeah, what he's saying is that the Maccabeans are going to rise up and people are going to join with them and they're going to be, some of them, some who join with them are really just sort of glomming on. Their hearts aren't really in the right place, but they're joining a movement and that sort of thing. We're also being told that they're having hard times. They're finding defeat in the middle of all of this, but they're being purified by that defeat, that their process, that this defeat has a positive force, a positive...
Join them in hypocrisy because they're really not with them.
They're going to attract a lot of followers, but not everybody. It's like today. If we get into, it's like what I said about what happened after 9/11. You know, people get up and start talking about our need for God, and everybody just runs to church, right? But then 60 days later, you can see that it was hypocrisy. The word hypocrisy means to wear a false face or a mask. It means to put on a face that isn't actually yours. It actually refers to the masks that are worn by Greek actors during their plays because they didn't have costumes like we do. They wore masks, and the mask sort of told you who they were. And that mask was called a hypocrite, or a false face. So, at any rate, there's a lot of people who are going to come and join them. So those who have insight will fall in order to refine and purge them. So the good people are going to be... the Maccabees paid a price. I mean, My Glorious Brothers talks about how glorious and wonderful was this great family, all of whom died in the process of freeing Israel from the Seleucids. So they'll pay a great price. But in order to refine and purge and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. So, in other words, their final victory is not now. Their final victory is later. What they gained was a seasonal victory to get them through a certain period of time, but it's not their final victory. Yes, sir?
Do we know the dates that Daniel was alive, or do we know how long? Okay,
yeah.
Can you tell me what they are?
Sure. I believe it's in this book right here. Daniel was hauled off into captivity in 605 BC. He was about 15 years old. So that meant that he was... and he died in the... Let me see. I'd say 530s or something. Hang on a minute. I'll find this for you.
He was like about 80 when he died.
About 80 when he died. So go from 605 plus 15 is 590. Minus 80 is 510 or 515, somewhere in that area. And I'm sure that this excellent book here has got it in here somewhere.
I don't need the exact date. I was just trying to...
He was born in 620.
That'd be 605 plus 15. And then 80, 540, 530, somewhere in there. He was at least 80 years old. We don't know exactly how long. So about 530 or so. We know that as far as late as 536 B.C., he is still prophesying. But he's old. He's very old. And once he gets this last prophecy out from under his belt, he's pretty much accomplished for our purposes what it is he needs to do. And by then, like I said, he's quite old. We know that he spent the entire time in captivity and was there when it was over. And so that all went out in 530-something. Other, what are you grinning at?
Your comment, he was quite old.
Yeah.
Abraham and some others.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, he was right. A mere lad. Of course, the problem of it is the body had, the human body had deteriorated quite a bit since then. Those old boys were made out of better stuff. Absolutely. What the Maccabees did was, remember with the setup, generation after generation of being stomped on by various groups, but the two groups going back and forth, people living for over 100 years in this oppression and that oppression, and these guys are our friends and now they're not our friends, and whatever. And then you get this secularization of the society and people beginning to feel like, well, the reason why God's not with us is because our society has become secularized. And when the Maccabees stand up and make a defense All it takes is a few victories and they start to galvanize the imagination of the people. And then a lot of people start jumping on before you know it, you got a movement. Some of those people weren't in it for exactly the good religious reasons, but they were there anyway. Other point of views? One of the things that that I kind of went past a little fast, but I just want to mention to you, is this notion of the stopping of the sacrifice. 1,150 days of morning and evening sacrifices, which is 2,300 sacrifices, morning and evening. The reason why that's important is because it shows up again later in the book of Revelation when we study back over there that particular reference. All right. I think I'll go ahead and start into some of this.
What does it say about it in Revelation?
It just says the same thing. It says the sacrifice was ended for 2,300 mornings and evenings, or 1,150 days. It's just, I'm just making the point that...
Is it referring to historical, or is
it... Yeah, it's referring to, it's referring to this particular event.
Can I ask you a side question?
Sure.
You had mentioned the Sadducees were paranoid about the Romans, you know, getting involved in their...
The Sadducees were a bunch of politicians who had power by their deal with the Romans. And whenever something would get out of hand, you got to remember what you're looking at. In Israel, at the time of Christ, prior to the time of Christ, Israel had been under the control of the Herodian family. The Herodian kings, the Herods, were Edomians, which means they were actually Edomites, descendants of Esau. But Herod the Great had converted, and so he was half Jew, so he's partially Jewish. Okay, so as a Jew, he converts, he becomes the most acceptable ruler that the Jews can embrace because he is for them in some levels. And as a bona fide for how much he is for them, he builds them the temple. He rebuilds the temple of Herod. Okay. He enlarges what on the spot. He makes it bigger and glorious and whatever. So the Herodian temple is his symbol that he is for them. And the Romans are thrilled. They finally got somebody who can manage the Jews that is acceptable to the Jews, and whatever. And so he does that. Now, Herod the Great was a ruthless man. In fact, he was the one who killed the innocents 2 years and under, whatever. A very, very ruthless man. And he had four sons. He actually had more sons, but he liked to kill them too much, and so he ran out. He was down to about four of them. Herod could kill sons like you'd squash bugs. He was ruthless. And so he had four sons: Antipas, Archelaus, Philip, and I always forget this other guy's name. He's where's my Bible? Anyway. Okay. Well, let me finish setting this. You're not going to get the short answer on this one. Anyway, he has these four sons, and I want to find this. I should know this like a back man. Don't get old. It's bad.
It's,
yeah.
It's the first time I can ever remember that you can't remember something.
Oh, no. It happens all the time. It happens all the time. This is my wife. Yeah, Philip, Archelaus, Antipas, and what's the other one? There's a chart in here. In fact, if you just give me a minute, I'll find it. Usually when I go to, when I lose it, I just can't remember where it is. Anyway, what happens is that I'm not doing any good here. I know this is here. Okay, hang on a minute here. It's on page 1160. Thank you, Jesus. Okay. Page 1160 in my Bible. Okay. Herod Antipas, Aristobulus, that's the guy, Aristobulus, Archelaus, and Philip. Now, Herod the Great was known as Antipater, which means the daddy, whatever. And then, but then his sons were Antipas, Archelaus, and Aristobulus, and Herod Philip. Herod Philip, we know most of because he was married to his sister Herodias. And Herodias liked him for a while and then decided she liked her brother Antipas better. So she moves from Philip's palace into Antipas' palace, moves in with him and brings her fetching young daughter Salome. Now, John the Baptist was fond of calling her a whore for this, and she didn't like it a whole lot. And so she kept trying to get Herod Antipas to kill him. He's a sly and sneaky guy. He's got his issues. So Herod Philip and Herod Antipas, Antipas is the one who killed John the Baptist. We know him from that. Herod Archelaus is known as the most ruthless of the sons. He was most like his father. He was Caligula's friend. He was the butcher who killed James. And when he died, he was eaten by worms. That's how he died. He went to a place where some people had made him upset, and they threw a great feast for him and called him and said, "You are the beauty of a god," and whatever. And he just basked in all that, and suddenly worms just began to consume him. It's like one of the great horror shows you've ever seen, you know. And he died being eaten by worms, which an angel brought upon him. And so he was a bad guy. Now, he was so ruthless that he caused so many uprisings in his territory that the Romans deposed him and put in his place, when he died, a procurator whose name was Pontius Pilate. Okay? Now, because the only place in Israel that wasn't ruled by the Herodian family was where Pontius Pilate was, out of Caesarea or Judea, and that's because of Archelaus being such a... he couldn't control the zealots. He was constantly killing people and all that kind of stuff. And that's why Pontius Pilate came to that particular spot. The fourth son, Aristobulus, is not even mentioned in the scriptures, but his son and grandson, they're known as Agrippa and Agrippa II. These are the people that Paul appeared before when he was on trial in that particular area. Now, somebody asked me a question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the curious thing, it was a very curious thing. I've always wondered, Pontius Pilate, if I have it right, had asked when Jesus came before him, said, "I find nothing, this man has done nothing wrong."
Right.
So that's always been very curious to me, you know,
yeah,
what's going on in his mind and all that,
yeah,
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the Romans sitting there being worried about, you know, rabble-rousers like Jesus,
mm-hmm,
you know, how did he come to say that? What was...
First of all, Pontius Pilate, okay?
Yeah.
Pontius Pilate, I just told you how he got there. Pontius Pilate was a Roman. He was appointed to this particular realm. And this is one of those make you or break you posts, okay? If you go to this particular kind of a embassy or a post and you rule well, then your next promotion is going to be a good place. If you don't rule well, you're going to be a dead-end place or the place where you're killed, one or the other, because the Romans had a way of dealing with procurators who didn't do real well. And so one of the things that you had to deal with is you wanted to keep the peace. You didn't want a bunch of uprisings. One of the things that could hurt you with Rome is if the rumor came that there was all these uprisings. And remember, Pontius Pilate's already in a place where Archelaus had ruled and it had been problematic all along. The second thing that could get you in trouble is if the leaders, the Jewish leaders of the area, were writing to Rome complaining about you all the time. And so what happens is that if you're going to be successful as a ruler in Rome, you need to not only keep the peace, but you need to sort of win the populace. So when Jesus comes along, and so part of what that did was, is Pontius Pilate, who was the ruler, sort of felt like he was a pawn. And he hated these Jewish leaders. He actually lived in Caesarea. He didn't live down in Judea. He just came down from time to time to settle their hash, you know, do their courts and all that kind of stuff, show up at their major feasts so that he could put in a ceremonial appearance. But he despised them, okay? So what happens is he's getting these guys coming in going, we want you to kill this guy. And he's going, okay, all right. And he's examining the guy and he's going, why? I mean, there's nothing wrong here. Now, he doesn't like the people that he's dealing with. Moreover, the scripture tells us, his wife, who is a spiritualist, has a dream. And in it, she sees the face of Jesus and she is terrified. And she sends a message to Pontius Pilate, don't have anything to do with this guy. Don't touch him. It will be cursed as a family if you do. I mean, it'll mean the death of us. So on the one hand, he's got his wife telling him to leave Jesus alone. He's got these guys wanting his death, and he can't really tell why. He doesn't really know if he kills this guy, some other group's going to rise up and protest, because he has no charge to write down. Do you remember that when Paul is taken to Rome to appear before Caesar, that at the very end they bring in Agrippa, and for Agrippa to judge this case? And when Agrippa looks at Paul's situation, he goes, there's nothing to charge him with. If we don't have a charge, we're going to get in trouble over there, okay? So since he has no valid charge against Jesus, this is not a fun case for him. And so he's basically trying to talk them down and, you know, let me beat him up a little bit. Let me scourge him, you know, let me really make his look whatever. But, you know, to crucify him, I have no charge for capital punishment. So he's conflicted by all these various things. And we know those things are going on. And it results in him saying, I don't find anything wrong with this guy, you know. Let me do something else for you. Let me release Barabbas to you, you know, or let me release another prisoner to you. Let me give you something else, trade you for it.
Well, he's trying to dance around the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he didn't want anything to do with it. He actually wants to wash his hands of it. Remember, they bring a pail of water, and that's where that phrase comes from. He wants to wash his hands from it. You knew that. Other questions here?
He later dies. I mean, he's killed from
that. Pilate is later brought back to Rome because he's never successful keeping the peace. And he's eventually brought back to Rome and executed for not being able to do it. There's also...
His wife said, I told you so, right? You
know, something like that, yeah. I hesitate to jump into this.
No.
I think we won't. Because I think next time we'll finish this, and I don't want to get half started. And next time we will finish. And then the week after that, we will start Zechariah, Haggai Zechariah, for those of you who want some more of this. Other comments before we quit out of here tonight? Next week would be the third, I guess. Now, you know what? For a couple of weeks there, everybody was going home confused. Is everybody no longer confused, I hope? I mean, you're seeing what's being said?
You see what you said, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next time.
Yeah. Okay. All right, who's going to pray us out?